Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Michael Newton Brown, a man of many talents. Listen to how a man who comes from a family that doesn't know from theater becomes someone who does everything in theater. And hear how in the pursuit of learning everything there is to know about theater, Michael's life gets tangled up with Bette Midler and Barry Manilow. Stay tuned. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show is, as I say, in one way or another every week, about being who you really are. Maybe you think I shouldn't say this every week. Maybe, if you've been listening every week, you don't need to hear it again. But I believe that none of us can really hear this too much. We live in a society that is really interested in conformity. It isn't interested in self-knowledge and self-acceptance and self-expression. Not unless that expression fits with what everyone else seems to think is appropriate, correct, whatever the conventional wisdom is. So, if you happen to be one of the very few, and I hope you are in the very few, who are born exactly the way the convention, the world you were born into, thinks people should be, then you don't have to listen to me, and you don't have to think about it. But in my experience, very few of us, maybe none of us really, are exactly what the culture is calling for. We look exactly what the culture wants us to look like. we sound exactly like what the culture wants us to sound like. And of course, even more importantly, we think and behave and are naturally the way the culture would want us to be. Since it is my belief that few, perhaps none of us, is cookie cutter to what our family of origin, the school we attended, the religion we were born into, the culture we are growing up in or come to live in, if we're not exactly what it would want us to be, then early on we learn that. And we learn it in not a pleasant way. Virtually everyone I talk to talks about this in one way or another, but I'm thinking about an interview I did with Mary Testa, who said that she was in a parochial school as a girl, and she was wrong in every way. She was Catholic when everyone else was Irish. She had big hair when everybody else did not. She was outspoken and dramatic and forthright when everyone else was kind of passive and goody girl. And, of course, these things, her dynamism, her connection to herself, you know, her very... Oh, she said she was big and everyone else was slight. Even that has served her in her career as an actress. She's dynamite on stage. But she had to live through a period where she was not what the convention, what the culture, what the school, what her, you know, approved of. Few of us have Mary Testa's courage and ability to stay true to the who we really are. So, I say this every week. Maybe there's a quality about you that is not what your family wanted or what your school approved of or what your siblings or your peers or your culture or the movies you see say is good. But the price that you pay for denying that which is you is bigger than the price, although there will be a price, for standing up and saying, you know, I know you'd like me to be thinner, to have straighter hair, not to laugh so loud, to be less assertive or more aggressive, but that's not me. Now, there's a price for that. I don't want to mislead you. There's a price. But, and we don't see that price until we stand up and say, this is me. And we also don't see the price that we are paying for self-denial until we are our very selves. As I always say, in order to make this point, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because it is so difficult to do in our culture, that those people who do it, like Mary Testa, do it because it's who they are. And my interview today is with Michael Newton Brown, who is, as many of the people that I interview are, demonstrating, has been demonstrating since he was little, that what he is a man of theater, of art, or as he will say towards the end of the interview, of magic. And when you listen to Michael, you can hear what it's like to have been born into a world that doesn't get it, and to have held fast to what it is to be Michael Newton Brown, who, as I said in the lead-in, can do just about anything that one can do in theater. Michael's story is interesting, because he comes from a family where his father was the track coach at school, the quintessential jock, I think Michael says of him. And still, Michael discovered very, very young that theater was his passion. And so he was able to find ways in his childhood to pursue that, and then to do everything. Stage managed, scene design, circus, lighting design, and directing, which is what he is currently doing for the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida, directing the musical Sunset Boulevard. And in this interview, you will not only hear the story of how Michael Newton Brown became Michael Newton Brown, but also his very interesting and thoughtful discussion of the piece, the movie, and the musical of Sunset Boulevard. So, now, here is Michael Newton Brown. So I am here with Michael Newton Brown. I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And that does describe you, does it not?
Pretty much.
Yes, right. Good. Okay, so I always ask the same question. And actually, just before I ask it, the art that you and I are talking about right now is director for theater, but that's not the only art that you have spent your life doing. Am I correct?
No, I'm a director, I'm a scenic designer, and I'm a lighting designer.
Aha!
As well.
Right. All of the things that are necessary to make the theater happen, right?
All the things that are necessary to keep you working in the business in one form or another.
Very nice. Very clever. Okay. So the question I ask is, how did it happen? Not how did you get your first job, but when, at the very beginning, did it occur to you that that theater was interesting, that designing was interesting, that color or story or... do you remember?
My dad tells me that he took me to the senior class play. He was a teacher. And I was just a little kid and not even in elementary school yet. And they did Ten Little Indians. And he said, I spoke of nothing for 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. Now, see, I don't remember that.
No.
But that's what he told me. And then my family, again, my family, we traveled in the summer, and we would go to New York. And I remember my first Broadway musical was Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, and I was 7 years old.
Uh-huh.
And all I can remember is the front curtain was all baseballs.
Uh-huh.
And I knew then, I fell in love with New York City. I said, this is where I belong.
At seven.
Like that, yeah.
Right, right.
My first professional show was in Summer Stock at 12.
I was going to say, no, don't get ahead, but you didn't get ahead. So how did you get from seven to a first professional show at 12?
Well,
did you say to your parents, this is what I want, I have to have lessons?
I just knew. And we had the old Flat Rock. We have a summer place in North Carolina, Hendersonville. And the Flat Rock Playhouse is up there that's been there forever, Equity Professional House. And I started taking courses in children's theater. And then they cast me as small role in one of the shows. So it was my first professional production. I was 12 years old.
Wow.
And then I went through all the drama club and everything in high school. And we're
so now you're an actor. Right, I mean, that's
that's how most everybody starts.
I know, right.
You know? But even then, I was watching the scenery, and I was watching the production.
And you remember the baseballs.
I remember the baseballs,
right.
You know. Mm-hmm. And then I did drama school, in thespians in high school and all of that, and president of the drama club, and where all my friends got their sweaters with their letters in... football and whatever else. I got mine in theater. I got all my points doing it in theater. And I learned then I didn't want to be an actor because I really liked having my fingers in all those other little pies. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I like creating the product.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. I'm interested that you said all my friends got letters in sports and I got it in theater. This is interesting to me because it suggests that you had friends across the board, that mm-hmm. you had friends who were jocks, you had friends who were whatever, but is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
My father was the track coach. My father is the ultimate jock.
Wow.
And they won all kinds of state awards and everything, and I used to do trapeze because I almost went circus. But I had a trapeze in the backyard, and that's how I worked out, is on the trapeze, and I could do ankle catches and heel catches and back layouts, and I could do all that. But the story is, because of that, my father decided that I would be a good pole vaulter. Because I could do the trapeze stuff. Mm-hmm. So he put me out there in the field with this pole in my hand, and nobody to tell me how to do it.
Run
down, stick the pole in that box, and go over the thing, and land in the sawdust. Do you know how nasty sawdust in your jockstrap is?
Oh, please.
No, not doing that. This is not for me. So I was a huge disappointment.
It's a real stretch who you became coming from there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. My family was not that at all. I was raised by my grandparents on his side.
So you were an only child then, essentially?
Yeah, I was the only child of an only child of an only child.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
Yeah, go ahead.
The point I was trying to make was, on those summer trips, because my father taught history and was a historian, I was dragged to every Civil War battlefield in the United States. Every ravine, every hill, every tree. And I have a wonderful appreciation of history. I love history.
Yeah.
I love museums.
Mm-hmm.
I love all of that. I love art museums. So they did instill in me.
It's ironic.
The other thing
that's ironic to me is that given who your father was and what he might have wanted you to be, that he told you that thing about your first experience in theater and how you wouldn't talk about anything else. He might not have told you that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah.
So he encouraged you in an interesting way.
He did. He said, you know,
he let you be, kind of.
He let me be.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There was one summer he didn't. It was after that summer of Stock, and I wanted to go back to that theater again that summer, and he says, no, you've experienced that. This summer, you're going to learn to play golf. God, was that a disaster. Then one summer, I took art. That was cool.
So you've got this childhood in which you essentially decide at the beginning where you want to spend your life, that you want to be in the theater somehow. And then you do the best that you can with what control you have over your own life,
mm-hmm.
to explore that in school and right. And then you take as many summers as they'll give you to, right? Okay. And then you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens?
I went to Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
And they had and they still have a very, very reputable theater program. And I spent 4 years at BU.
And majoring in theater?
Director. You could major directing, designing, acting. And I went in as a director. And so the first 2 years, I was doing all kinds of production stuff. They make you do that. And I had incredible acting classes and all. And at one point I wanted to leave, about going into my junior year. I wanted to leave because it was too big. It was really too big. And I felt like I wasn't getting the intimacy of a small program,
mm-hmm.
where you're like a family.
Right.
But I found out that if I left, I would lose tons of credits, and I was over school. I was really over school. And I would lose a ton of credits, so I said, I'll just stick this out. And then junior and senior year, I started getting gigs that other people were not getting. I was asked to stage for the opera. No undergraduate was ever asked to stage manage for the opera. That was a graduate director gig. And I was getting gigs like that. And then they did a big musical every year. BU was not a musical school. It's more serious. But they did a big musical, and I was asked to stage manage the big musical. And there was some flack about that. But
from whom? Other students?
Yeah. Grad students were not pleased.
because they didn't get
to do it because, you know, they needed it for the credit.
Right.
But I didn't have anything to do with it. They just asked me to do it. And then I think the most interesting thing about the Boston University experience is it was senior year, 1970. And in the spring of 1970 was Kent State,
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnam War, and then Jackson State. And our school, BU is an urban campus, so it's not like, it's along streets in the city. And our school happened to be by the National Guard Armory. And people were rioting and throwing Molotov cocktails. And we woke up one morning in May, I guess it was, and we were told, go home.
Because it's too dangerous.
And, we were told, you'll be graded on whatever you've done in this semester. There will be no exams. Go home. Go home now.
Oh, my goodness.
School is closed.
Oh.
And we didn't get to see everybody to say goodbye.
Oh, it was the end.
Bam. Cut off.
Oh, my God.
And a few of us were able to get together in a professor's apartment and have a little party and say goodbye.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And then we were doing a show then that was going to be going to the National College Theater Festival in Washington. A friend of mine was a stage manager. I said, get me a gig. I want to go. Mm-hmm. So we went down there and performed at the festival. However, that was during the last big peace march.
Jeez.
We were tear gassed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were tear gassed. And we came out of a restaurant eating and looked down the street, and here they came down the street with the cops after them. And we went right back in the door of that restaurant, and they locked the door of the restaurant.
Well, so you were right in the middle of that.
I was in the middle
of all
that.
Even though you were not in the middle of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You were collateral damage.
Sort of, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also one of those naked people waving at you from the reflection pond. So it was exciting times.
It was.
It was exciting times.
Well,
yeah.
So you're out of school.
Yeah.
Bang, bang.
And I had applied to Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College, mm-hmm. back to the circus, thinking I could meet somebody who could teach me circus. And anyway, I got accepted. And this is, again, 1970. And there were 3,000 applicants then, and they accepted 30 people. And I was one of them.
Wow.
And I went through 8 weeks of hardcore basic training, circus training, down here in Venice at the old arena. Mm-hmm. And got a contract on the Red Show. And I went on the Red Show for a year.
That's what is the Gable. Red Show?
They had three shows. Well, then they had two shows. The Red Show and the Blue Show. They alternated routes. They had two shows out.
Ah.
The Red Show was with Gunter Gable Williams. Mm-hmm. And I was on the road for a year with the Red Show.
Did you like it?
No.
Ah.
No, I didn't. It was really a learning experience. I've never been so lonely in the midst of a group of people in my life.
Because you're not really a circus person?
Because it's very stratified.
Really?
Well, Ringling. Right. Was very, because Ringling is huge and very corporate. And smaller shows are more family-oriented.
Right.
But the Bulgarians hang with the Bulgarians, the Hungarians hang with the Hungarians.
Really?
Animal people hang with animal people, aerialists with aerialists. And as a clown, you're like way towards the bottom of the social ladder, just above the showgirls.
Wow.
And not a lot of cross
pollination
between that. And then, you know, you had the workers as well. So I had about three good friends who were also clowns on the show. And I learned that that wasn't for me.
Wow. A lot of experiences that you had to learn what was not for you.
Oh, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I think some of the most of my best learning experiences has been what not to
do. What not to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know. And
so, okay, what are you now, about 22, 24, something like that?
21, 22.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the show, I went back to New York. I got my equity card. I went to New York because I was not going to go back in that town without my union card for theater. And I met someone and fell in love. And that someone had mutual friends who had been doing hair.
Mm-hmm.
Hair was still a big deal,
mm-hmm.
then. And they had been staging it in the country, different companies. Because in this country, you had they didn't tour so much. They had the Boston company, the LA company, the Detroit company. And they were putting those together. And then they got the gig for Scandinavia. And they'd been in Scandinavia for about a year and a half. And they called Jimmy to come over and be a company manager. And as soon as he could, Jimmy got me over there. And I didn't know what I was going to wind up doing. I thought I was going to be doing hair. But Superstar had just, Jesus Christ Superstar had just opened in New York and was this smash. They got the rights. And I got over there, and they had just opened a Superstar in Copenhagen. And then we were going to go join what's the equivalent of the national tour in Örebro, Sweden, which was somewhere north of the Arctic Circle.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in ice halls.
Oh, and, God.
I know. And so I wind up there. Here I am. And I'm running a light board.
Mm-hmm.
And the lighting designer, this will come out later, the lighting designer for that had been Jewel Fisher's assistant on Broadway for the lighting design for Jesus Christ Superstar.
I was so wondering what he was doing in the ice.
Yeah, as were we all. Anyway, the crew was Swedish, Norwegian, Czechoslovakian, and, well, there's another one in there, maybe German. And so the stage manager would give the setup for a cue, and then you hear it translated over the headsets, and everybody knew the word go.
Oh, how funny. That's great.
Oh, it's really funny.
That's great.
It was really funny. And so after that, lived in Europe, made a ton of money, lived in Europe, waiting for these producers to get their act together for the show to go to Norway. And had a flat in London for about 6 weeks. And then we had friends in Athens, Greece, who had gone to school at Columbia. And they were married, and so we went down to Carnelis' place in Athens, which was just down the hill from the Parthenon.
So this career has helped you to see the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and we stayed in the old family villa.
Oh.
And we were there for 6 or 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it was during Papadopoulos' regime. Very interesting. We were warned by our friends, don't talk politics to anyone. Don't talk politics to cab drivers. People disappear off the streets.
Oh, my God.
Be a dumb tourist. Yeah. And they wouldn't talk to us until we went, like, out of the city to a beach where we could sit on a hill overlooking the beach.
And see if there was anyone around.
Only then would they talk to us.
Wow.
Because they were very anti-Papadopoulos. And there were gun tourists. Manned. Gun tourists. But Athens was so safe.
Yes, you know. I bet it was.
Yeah, because we were, the Acropolis is just like a big hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on one side of this Plaka, which is the old Athens. And then we were over the hill in whatever this neighborhood was. And you could eat dinner or go to the bars, whatever. And you could be coming home any hour of the day or night. And it was absolutely safe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you give and you get, right?
You give and you get, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So came back to New York after that and did a couple off-Broadway shows, stage managing a couple off-Broadway shows and some summer stock. And then I get this phone call from this guy who was the lighting guy in Sweden. He's back in the States. He's formed his own lighting design company, and his first big gig is a young lady named Bette Midler, who just had a big hit with Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, and it was the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy tour, and it was out in L.A., and he couldn't do it because he got a Beach Boys gig, and would I come out and take over lighting that tour? Sure. So I went out and brought the show back to Broadway, One Night Stands. Now, that was interesting, because she had just done that famous Carson show, First time she was on Carson, and they had tried to get her to come on, and she refused to come on unless she could bring her band and her girls and do it her way. And finally, they relented, and that was the night America discovered Bette Midler.
The Divine Miss M.
The Divine Miss M. They taught me the show in San Francisco, and the next gig was something like Phoenix. And I looked out at the audience, and I thought, thought, they're going to kill us. They're going to kill us. Because the mix was the most amazing thing. You had these families, the grandparents, the parents, and a couple little kids, sitting next to two drag queens in gold and silver lame. And that is the dichotomy of what this audience was. And you'd have a drag queen coming down the aisles in roller skates dressed as a bride. And you know, and you could hear a pin drop in this audience because you know they were all absolutely scared to death of each other.
Right.
And I look, this happened night after night. You know, Phoenix, Albuquerque, down. I'm going, oh, jeez. But she would walk out on that stage. The band would come out. Manilow was her musical director. Bette would come out with slacks, a white blouse, two white fans, 2 minutes standing ovation.
Really?
Yeah. And she'd finally have to say, shut up, sit down, I ain't done nothing yet. And they would. And by the end of the show, the end of the evening, they were dancing together. It was just, I can only imagine all the stories about Garland.
Mm-hmm. How she crossed the lines,
what she was, because I would stand there in the wings, and I'm seeing it every night in a different theater, and it's just, it was incredible to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Manilow's biggest gifts is producing a show. He is consummate, consummate artist when it comes to putting together a music show.
In what way?
He knows what works.
Ah.
He knows how to make it work musically. He knows how to line up the songs. He knows how to work the emotions.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really brilliant. Brilliant.
So he wrote it?
Well,
essentially, in collaboration with her.
With her, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah. And Bruce Valanche, do you know Bruce Valanche?
I do not.
Bruce Valanche, there's a wonderful documentary you should see called Get Bruce. He was a writer in Chicago, newspaper writer in Chicago. Funny, 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 funny man. And he started writing for Bette. And he's written the Academy Awards, he's written the Emmys, he's written all these. And you hear Whoopi Goldberg and all these comedians talk about Bruce Valanche. He took Harvey Fierstein's place on Broadway in Hairspray as Edna, did it for 2 years. And anyway, Bruce and, what's his name? I can't remember, it was another guy. Who I would be in the dressing room, and Bruce would just be there talking, and Bruce is the funniest thing in the world. Just one thing comes out of his mouth after another. And Bette's getting ready, putting on her makeup. She goes out on stage, and there's all this stuff that Bruce was doing.
She's using it.
She's using it.
Mm-hmm.
She's using it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, crazy. Then she had this hit. We wound up at the Palace on Broadway for Christmas. And she took a break. And Manilow was going out because he just had his first album, Mandy.
Mm-hmm.
And I write the songs. And he was going out and playing the clubs, the music rooms, to promote it and asked me to go with him. And I was with that for 3 years, and from leaky pipe basement music rooms all around the country, I saw us go to 17,000 seat arenas.
Wow.
And huge outdoor music festivals and Broadway again.
Wow.
Yeah. So now how old are we?
Yes. What's interesting about this is that you went, essentially, you went from virtually nothing to everything in a very short period. I mean, it was a huge leap. You sort of leapfrogged over a number of steps, kind of like what you did in school, where you shouldn't have been the stage manager for the opera or for the musical, but you sort of leapfrogged over the...
It did.
Right?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And when I had time off, I'd be back in New York in the summer directing something off Broadway, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was trying to make the transition to Broadway, and it was difficult. And I was also being a lighting designer. Now I was being known as a lighting designer for rock and roll, which was verboten then.
Yeah.
That was a whole other thing. Broadway didn't want
to know from that yet.
They didn't
get it yet.
They didn't get it. And my oldest best friend, I told you about it during the wedding, he was production manager for opera companies. So when they came off the road, bearing, I guess, he said, come to the Providence Opera and do Light This Opera. And I said, Scotty, I don't know the first thing about lighting opera. He said, yes, you do. It's a long, slow musical. I said, oh, okay, I can do that. So I learned how to light opera, and I was lighting opera all over the country. And then...
Is that an entree into Broadway when rock and roll is... No, that isn't either.
It's its own separate beast.
Right, right.
And I had started in 76 coming back to Florida because I had gotten... New York was trying to pigeonhole me.
Well,
are you a director? Are you a lighting designer? What are you?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I can do
yes.
it all. Yes. Yes to all of that.
Yes.
And they couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
And my family was... I'm from Clearwater. I'm like fourth generation Floridian.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
So my family's down here getting older. I started coming back more to help them. And between 76 and 80, it would be a month in Florida, 2 months in New York, 2 months in Florida, 1 month in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working down here.
Oh.
And people were happy to have me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't being pigeonholed.
Mm-hmm.
So
and they were glad that you had all these skills.
Yeah. And by 80, I had moved pretty much back. And there was a huge in Tampa Bay professional theater scene. Excuse me. Dinner theater. But if you want to work in Florida,
mm-hmm.
that's what you did. So I worked constantly. And then I was, because of the lighting, I was getting regional theaters. Coconut Grove Playhouse in Miami. Burt Reynolds Theater when he
mm-hmm.
had it.
Yeah.
Syracuse Stage. And I met a director who liked my work, and he was been working on a project called Jerry's Girls, which is the music of Jerry Herman.
Mm.
And they had been working it, and he asked me to come light, to meet Jerry Herman in Key West, and then, depending upon how that went, to light the national tour.
Right, right.
With Carol Channing, Leslie Uggams, and Andre McArdle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so I got the gig. I did it. It was supposed to go to Broadway. But Miss Channing could not stand this director. And she refused to go as long as he was directing the show. Well, she didn't own the show. He did.
He did. I was just going to say, right.
Anyway, that's sort of a long story. But I did that. And I got Disney on Ice. I did a Disney and Ice show. I did a big ice show at Busch Gardens that ran for 5 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I wound up doing less and less of the road because I didn't... I'd done it for like 5 years.
Yeah,
you
really?
Know, one-nighters in it. 5 years. And going out and doing the opera, it would be 10 days, but 10 very lonely days because my schedule was very different from their schedule, and it started off really easy for me, and then towards the end it got really, really intense and difficult. So I didn't have time to socialize very much.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time in a hotel, and I didn't like that
no.
so much. I didn't like that so much. So I've done less, much, much less up the road.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I was working more down here.
Yeah, and there is work here.
And Michael is currently directing Sunset Boulevard for the Players Theater in Sarasota. And I asked him to tell me about the play.
We were so excited to get Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And it's an area premiere. Nobody has ever done it. And no tour ever came here.
So will you tell me a little bit about what it was that made you want to get your hands on this show?
I love the story. I love the original Billy Wilder movie,
mm-hmm.
which... And is arguably the epitome of film noir. It was a very shocking film to people. And it's just a genius. There's so much of Hollywood history that he put in the film. Gloria Swanson, whose career, her silent film career, actually did diminish when the talkies came in. And Gloria Swanson then went to New York and was a very, very successful businesswoman. And they asked her to come back to do Sunset Boulevard. So there is a lot of correlation between her career and Norma Desmond, whose famous career went down the tubes when the talkies came in and she was forgotten. When you see the movie of Sunset Boulevard, they're looking at a little black and white of her earlier acting. It is actually Gloria Swanson.
Wow.
Directed by Max, who becomes Max, the butler,
right,
in Sunset Boulevard. I mean, Hedda Hopper is in this thing, mm-hmm, and Buster Keaton is in it, and just little cameos in the bridge game, her friends who would come to play bridge. It's Buster Keaton and three other names I couldn't tell you. I don't know, but they were famous silent film stars. And then, you know, Billy Wilder, who wrote it, who's noted for things like Some Like It Hot.
Oh, yeah, the comedies.
Oh, the comedies.
Right.
The comedies. Well, Billy Wilder came to America from Germany prior to the war and had to learn English and all went to Hollywood and worked his way up to become a signature.
Billy Wilder.
Billy Wilder.
Right.
And he wrote this as a horror story, which it very much is, a psychological horror.
Listen, I can still see her face.
Oh.
And I'll never forget
coming
it.
Coming down the stairs.
Coming down the stairs.
Oh, my
I'm
God.
Ready for my close-up. I mean, it's burned.
It's burned. I mean, and there's so many signature moments. As you said, I'm ready for my close-up. You know, I am big. It's the movies that got small.
That's right.
There's all these little tidbits in there. And it's so tightly woven. And it's about Paramount. And it was actually shot on the back blocks and everything at Paramount. Billy Wilder didn't want the studio to know what this film was about. So when they pitched it, it was pitched as something else under a different title. And they got the green light to shoot. The script wasn't finished when they started shooting. And he would only submit 3 or 4 or 5 pages at a time, because he was working around the green something code. I can't remember what it was, but one of those...
The sensors.
Sensors, mm-hmm, code. Plus, he didn't think Louis B. Mayer...
would like it.
...was going to like it.
Right.
And he was exposing the dark side of Hollywood.
Yeah. Right.
And it's... I mean, when you see that first image in the film, and it says Sunset Boulevard, and it's stenciled onto a curb, mm-hmm, you know, that's... in the sewer.
Oh.
I mean, that is the image. The name Sunset Boulevard, we all know the iconic street, Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. But it is about the story of the boulevard to Norma's sunset.
Oh, my goodness.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
You know? and when the and also... at that particular time, after World War II, the American woman was expected to have left the factories.
Yeah, and gone back to her.
And gone back to the kitchen.
Womanness.
Womanness,
right,
in the kitchen.
Right.
And the femme fatale was the woman in the kitchen. And then Norma Desmond hit the scene. And nobody had ever seen anything like this Norma Desmond. And she created a new femme fatale,
yes,
of the crazed woman. And then you had the Joan Crawfords, and you had the Betty Davises, and you had all those other films. This was the precursor.
Wow.
So it was incredibly shocking.
Right.
To audiences. And when it was shown in a private screening, Louis B. Mayer... came up, he was livid. He came up to Billy Wilder and said that he should be ashamed of himself for what he's done to the industry that has given him such wealth.
Right, right, right.
And that he should be drummed out of Hollywood.
Well, we can see that didn't happen.
And never work again. To which Billy Wilder went up to him and said, Mr. Mayor, hello, I'm Billy Wilder, and go fuck yourself. Yeah. So then, of course, over the years, it's become such an iconic
film. Yes, it is.
Iconic film. There were several attempts into making it a musical that all fizzled, including Stephen Sondheim.
Really?
Stephen Sondheim was at a party. He had wanted to do it, and he was at a party where he met Billy Wilder and told him that he wanted to do a musical out of Sunset. And Billy Wilder said, you can't make a musical out of Sunset Boulevard. It is an opera. Then Weber, Andrew Lloyd Webber, he had some collaborations with some other people trying to do it, and it didn't all quite come together. And I can't remember what the instance was that made it come together for him, but it was right after he had done Aspects of Love. He wanted to focus on this and did it. And one of the greatest things he did was kept most all the dialogue from the film. Mm-hmm. And what he couldn't, he wove it musically into it. And I fell in love with it in New York. I didn't see New York. I saw the First National. And I thought, it's such an incredible story. But it was so overproduced because it's famous for this big house flying in, you know, and flying out. And, you know, sometimes Broadway just really overdoes it. I thought, my God, this is a beautiful, beautiful score, and this is a beautiful, beautiful story. And, of course, when it first came out, there was a lot of critique. Hither, thither, and yon. Is it good? Is it not good? Da, da, da. And after the original London, the next one that opened was the L.A. that was going to New York. Well, they tweaked L.A. It was a different show.
Really?
And then once L.A. was up and going, and that one was coming to New York, Glenn Close, they closed the London for a period of time to put the changes from New York and L.A. into the London show, which supposedly, from what I've read, really did tighten it up and make it a much, much better piece. But to me, it's a psychological horror story. It's right up there with Sweeney Todd. Mm-hmm. It's right up there with Jekyll and Hyde. You know? Mm-hmm. And
it's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. On many levels.
Yes, exactly.
It doesn't work on one level. It works on many.
It's a tragedy, actually, for
levels.
All of them.
Yeah. It's a tragedy from all of them. There really is only one innocent in the whole show.
The girl.
Betty.
Right.
And it's a tragedy
for her as well.
And I think the writing is so, so clever. And as we're working the scene work, I see the writing, what it says, but then I'm seeing what's not being said by the writing.
You mean what you intuit because it's not there, or?
Yeah. There's this wonderful duet in the second act called Too Much in Love to Care between Betty and Joe. And if you hear the song, you think it's a typically bombastic fall in love, we're in love song. And then when I was working with my actors, I said, now, I want you to put that out of your head. This is a quiet conversation because both of them don't understand the attraction. Both of them, their lives are headed in a different direction and then they met and they don't understand the feelings. You know, and there's a lyric in there where it tells us, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, let's just throw it away.
Yeah.
Meaning, Let's follow the rules and throw this away because it's not right. But by the time they get to that lyric again, later on, they're going to throw away the rules.
Mm-hmm. Very smart.
Yeah, no, very, very interesting. And I'm so blessed. I have amazing, amazing actors doing these roles. people are just going to be pretty much blown away. I mean, the acting chops,
really?
The singing chops, they can sing this stuff. And it's hard, it's legit.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it's written, it's one of the toughest scores I've ever done, because you're going from 4-4 to 6-4 to 2-4 to 5-4 to 7-4 back to 4-4 and maybe three measures of this and two measures of that. And
wow.
Yeah. And you have, with the acting ensemble, you have, everyone has their own individual staging choreography of what it is that they are doing, which is not what anybody else is doing. They have to count it.
Oh, my.
And it doesn't count in eights. Sometimes it's sixes.
Oh, my.
And then they have to know when to come in on all of their solos, because they're overlapping.
Who's musical directing it?
Joyce Valentine.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and she is in love
with the score.
The score and the lushness of the score, because it sounds like grand opera.
Uh-huh. I can see why you wanted this. I mean, it's everything, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think people know what they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're going to come in expecting what they're going to see.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, okay, so it's opening on...
We open January 10th, a Thursday. We're running through the 20th.
Okay.
And there is a possible extension of the 27th through
yes,
the,
but
Sunday
don't
the 27th.
Yes, but don't wait. Wait. Come,
don't wait.
Come to opening night. There'll probably be a preview on the...
We're doing a preview on the Wednesday, the 9th.
The 9th.
The
okay.
9th.
Right, great.
And then I think the word will start getting out very quickly.
I'm sure.
Because it's such a unique piece. Such a unique piece.
And it is being directed by a unique and special talent, Michael Newton Brown. So now, I always ask as the sort of final question, when someone has given a life, as you actually have, I mean, pretty much your entire life, as much as you have had control over, you have dedicated to the theater in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult path to choose in the world that we live in. So do you have anything that you would want to say about what it was like so far to have dedicated an entire life to various aspects of the theater?
I've always felt that I was blessed. I was very lucky. I was given the talents to create magic. And it comes back to me in the most surprising ways that somebody will come up to me and say, "You touched me."
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago. And you influenced my decisions on many things 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And I have a young lady I work with now who's incredibly talented. And her mama had to remind me that I had directed her when she was 12 years old in a performing arts group in St. Pete.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't regret anything. It's given me a very nice life. Money isn't everything. I have wonderful friends. And... I'm respected by my peers, which is the greatest gift.
Yes.
It doesn't matter how many awards you're nominated for or win. It's to have the respect of your peers.
Yes.
So I can't regret anything.
No, it's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Money isn't everything, and I don't regret a thing. What a wonderful thing to be able to say about your life. I believe that I was lucky. I was blessed. I was given something that I can give away that gives back to me. Wow. Would that we all could say that about our lives. And, of course, you know that I believe that we can all say that about our lives if we are fortunate enough to have been able to do what Michael did. Definitely no theater in his family. However, he knew so young that art, theater, drama, stories, these were the things that drew him. And so, although he agreed to learn golf, although he let his dad give him a pole vault, right? He endured it all. But underneath, he held tight to his certainty of who he is. And he used every opportunity. He studied it in school. He pursued it in college. Never mind that his college was cut short. Never mind all of the obstacles that seemed to stand in his way. He stayed true to Michael. And that, of course, is what I am trying to get you to see, to recognize, to be aware of, that there's someone in there who you may not be aware of, in touch with, and therefore able to honor. But when you can do that, then you can say, as Michael has said, I have no regrets. I am aware of what is important. And it isn't money. And it isn't even fame. For Michael, it is the respect of his peers and the fact that he knows that he does magic and that he touches other human beings. So, I hope that Michael's story has motivated you to look inside and see if maybe there's somebody in there that you have been denying, that you can say hello to and begin the process of exploring, accessing, and therefore enjoying. Intended to play a song from Sunset Boulevard to give you a taste of what Michael was talking about, but the interview was long and I didn't want to cut any more of it than I had to, so I don't have time, and you're just going to have to come down and see Sunset Boulevard yourself and hear the glorious score that Michael was talking about. And now there's just enough time to thank Josh Hackney for all of the amazing gifts that he has given me during the year and continues to give me as I continue to need new things. He continues to come up with new skills. And so if you need someone who can help you with a computer, with recording, with electronics, with iPhone, with, you want Josh Hackney. And, oh my goodness, I think I have not given my website out in this show. How sad. So it is thelynnshow.com. THELYNNE. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. SHOW. Thelynnshow, one word, .com. And you can get access to Josh up there and access to me just by clicking on email me and saying, I want to talk to Josh, or I want to talk to you, Lynn. I'm interested in therapy on the phone. I'd like to get a copy of your book. I like something, didn't like something about your show. I'd like to talk about something else. Well, pretty much whatever you want to say, I'm happy to listen to. And so now, in the seconds I have left, I want to say that, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, have both seen better days. I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not.